The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 364, The Quest for Peace in the Middle East by J. Bonner Ritchie.
My name is Greg Campbell, and we're about to listen to a paper that will be given by J. Bonner Ritchie, who is a professional organizational behaviorist and a consultant to Palestinian organizations. He's also a member of the Sunstone Foundation Board of Trustees. He'll be giving a paper called The Quest for Peace in the Middle East, and he'll be responded to by Charles Randall Paul, who is a Ph. candidate who studies methods of religious conflict. The chair for the session will be Russell Fox, and we will go to him now for the introductions of our speakers.
We'd like to welcome you all out to this session at Sunstone Symposium. I'm really excited to be able to participate in this session. We have with us, speaking on the topic of the quest for peace in the Middle East, J. Bonner Ritchie, a professor of organizational behavior at Brigham Young University, chairman of the Board of Trustees for the Sunstone Foundation, and an individual whose efforts on behalf of numerous different organizations is well known to, I'm certain, everyone here. We also have speaking with us today in partial reply to Professor Ritchie's statements, Charles Randall Paul. He's a BYU graduate in social psychology and a Harvard MBA. He's currently pursuing a PhD at the University of Chicago at their Committee for Social Thought, studying methods of engaging in religious conflict. Since this session is being both taped and broadcast over the radio, after the speakers are finished with their statements, we'd appreciate anyone who had comments and questions to address them into the microphone. And so without any further ado, we'll turn the time over to Professor Ritchie.
Thank you. It's fun to be here. Partly because I care deeply about the topic I'm discussing. I don't do much anymore, and anymore means in the last decade, that I don't feel strongly about. I used to be a detached scholar. Now I'm a passionate crusader. And I feel very strongly about this issue. And so let me get my biases out front. Also, let me make a very explicit statement about this issue. I am very optimistic about the Middle East. Most people aren't. I am very optimistic, and I want to make that clear. And therefore, that is important in interpreting what I say. I'm very concerned about Palestinian rights, and I'm very optimistic about the Middle East. Everybody doesn't take those stands, and I acknowledge them up front. A couple of weeks ago, I was in Amman, Jordan, at a banquet the evening of the signing and speeches by Yitzhak Rabin and King Hussein in Washington. And I was sitting at dinner next to a long-term member of the Jordanian cabinet, a cabinet minister. And we had listened to Rabin and King Hussein and President Clinton, and they had outlined some fairly optimistic and ambitious goals for the future of the Jordanian-Israeli relationship, as well as the larger Arab-Israeli relationship. And this individual, with a choked voice, said, "Why did it take so long? Why did it take King Hussein so long? Why are my people so stubborn?" And then he said, "No, those are the wrong questions. Those comments are really indicative of the larger issue." He says, "The real issue is, why did I remain a passionate anti-Zionist entity," which is the term used in the traditional Arab world when talking about Israel. They would never use the term Israel. even on last year's maps of the Middle East published in Jordan, Israel is not identified by name. It's just a block of land with some cities in it, perhaps identified with the term Palestine. But why did I remain, over all these years, so hostile, so passionately anti-Zionist entity, in spite of all the realities that have changed and that have forced us to reframe the way we think about the world? And, you know, of course, I have no answer, except to acknowledge that these things take time. Especially do they take time in a society as traditional as Muslim Arab society. They take an inordinate amount of time. Some people wonder if time is running out or had run out. I'm excited to note that time didn't run out, that the world didn't blow up before several things happened and are continuing to happen. But it was fun to be in Jordan that day. It was fun to drive down the streets and to see people waving Palestinian flags, which are very similar to the Jordanian flag, just a small emblem of the colors are the same. But see them waving Palestinian flags and to hear people talk about the enthusiastic possibility of the future for the country of Jordan. And, of course, to hear all the cynical comments about Hafez al-Assad in Syria and what the Jordanian negotiations meant in terms of Syria, and to talk about Iraq and Iran and Saudi Arabia and the PLO, and to see the incredible complexity of the ongoing Mideast peace process and why it takes so long to develop just a beginning point, not an ending point, just a beginning point for discussion. And of course, this individual went on to say that he feared greatly for King Hussein's life as a result of his willingness to go to Washington and his willingness to shake hands with Yitzhak Rabin. And Prince Hassan, who is the heir to the throne, the younger brother of King Hussein, had several threats on his life that day, and the situation is very volatile. But they went ahead. Now, some people say they went ahead because they had no choice. Economic conditions being what they are, the forgiveness of the $7 billion debt of Egypt during the Gulf War negotiations was accompanied by debt forgiveness for Jordan as part of the deal of a negotiation with Israel. That's world politics. But let me attempt to put the whole thing in perspective. And I would hope, my goal today, is that each of you might go away with a little different insight. Not a whole revised philosophy of life. That's a hidden agenda of mine, but I'm honest enough to admit that it's not an honest agenda, and it's not a realistic agenda, but just a slightly different perception. Maybe one insight that you didn't have before about life in that world and about the future. Maybe one perspective, maybe one point of view, maybe one fact, if there are any such things that any of you might entertain, but at least an idea that might give you a different way of looking at things. First of all, it ought to be clear that the UN mandate, the UN partition plan in 1947-48, granted a Palestinian state. I was expecting an overhead here that I could show a map, but let me just draw one in the air and you can extrapolate from that. The original area of Palestine is 100 miles across and 300 miles up and down. Not a very large area. And in 1947, in one of their first actions, the United Nations developed a partition plan to create a Palestinian state and an Israeli state, a Jewish state. And they were each about half of the state with touching borders at a couple of points, where the Israeli state had much of the south, Beersheba down to Eilat, the Negev, and the area around Haifa, Tel Aviv, and then the Galilee. And the Palestinian state cut sort of the north and then the central current west bank and then Gaza Strip and a cut into the Negev. The Israeli population, the Jewish population, accepted the partition plan. The Palestinian population rejected it, or the Palestinian leadership rejected it. And with that rejection has come the 1948 to 1994 era of negotiation and conflict and occupation and war, a very tragic period with a lot of deaths and a lot of tragic consequences. But the Palestinians weren't ready. People say, isn't it sad that they didn't accept it? And the answer is yes. And isn't it sad that South Africa couldn't have been a free racial state a long time ago? And isn't it sad that the United States, with our declarations of independence and our beautiful Constitution, had to maintain a tragically racist reality for such a long time? Yes, it's sad, but they weren't ready. And I don't think it could have worked. There were several times in the last 40 years when Jordan and Israel have been very close to final agreement on negotiations, where King Hussein has met with virtually all Israeli prime ministers, and going back a long ways, his grandfather, King Abdullah, met with the early Israeli leaders and was ready to sign agreements. But it wasn't ready. And the reasons it wasn't ready are critical. And let me outline some of the reasons why then it wasn't and why now it might be, but still some of the problems in the current reality. First of all, then and for a long time, the Middle East was a pawn in the power play of East-West relations. And the demise of the Soviet Union was an absolutely critical step to proceeding on Mideast peace. And so the shift in power balance was something that was critical. The Soviet Union and the United States used their puppet regimes, that's too strong a term, used their satellite states in the Middle East to fight the Cold War. The Syrian-Soviet, the Iranian or Iraqi-Soviet connections, the Egyptian-Soviet on-and-off relationships over time, those things generated incredibly difficult contexts. And in the same way, thank you very much, in the same way that we look at the dilemmas of the current power balance, we have to understand that earlier power balances dictated policy not unlike what we saw in Southeast Asia or in Central America, other places where we have attempted to manipulate in very troublesome ways the behavior of so-called autonomous governments. The dark area on the overhead was the state of Palestine as determined by the United Nations. The white area was the state of Israel. It should be noted, ironically, that we've spent the last 40 years trying to regain about a third of what was originally offered freely as a state of Palestine. That's a very symbolic issue. Now, the reason it's terribly symbolic, in addition to the power balance and the need for the Soviet money providing both terrorist support and MiGs to Arab countries, the need for that to go is also accompanied by the need for us, United States, for some of you who may be Canadian or otherwise not share the us, I know that's true of some, for the United States to also realize that they don't have to have a testing ground for their F-16s in Israel, and that they don't have to have the Israeli arena to play out the Cold War. The land is a critical variable in that process. And the reason it wasn't possible or appropriate in 1948 is that the most sacred of responsibilities for an Arab, more particularly a Muslim Arab, is the land, the sanctity and the sacredness of the land. Many people will say that the first question God will ask when you go to heaven is how well you cared for the land. The land is sacred beyond comprehension in Western individual philosophy. So, with that understanding of the land, the Palestinians, 4 out of every 5 Palestinians who lived in the area that is white on that map, which was the original design of the State of Israel, 4 out of 5 were evicted and were forced to flee and became known as the popular term Palestinian refugees. Some of them went to the West Bank, which was governed by Jordan from 48 to 67. Some went to Gaza, which was governed by Egypt during that period. A lot went into the East Bank of the Jordan River, which is the current state of Jordan, and a lot came to Chicago. They went everywhere. But the point is, 4 out of 5 were evicted, and they lost their land. And they were promised by a lot of people, and if not by specific people, by an implicit understanding of their divine destiny, that they were promised that they would return to that land, that their homes in Jaffa, their homes in Haifa, would be theirs again. And to this day, when you walk into a refugee camp in the West Bank or in Jordan or in Lebanon, you see keys hanging on the wall of their home in Tel Aviv, their home in Haifa, that they are going back to someday. The sacredness of that land is beyond our comprehension, but we must try to understand how they could not surrender that land easily and without an enormous amount of pain and a lot of other things that went along, like maybe 40 years of tragic conflict and separation of families and realization that something had to change, but it could not be done immediately. So, the land is critical. And as I say, many will argue that the first thing that is said upon arrival in heaven is how well did you accept stewardship for the land. And so working that out is absolutely critical. And the position taken by current groups, the Islamic Salvation Front in Algeria, Hezbollah and the Islamic Jihad in Lebanon, the Muslim Brotherhood in Jordan and Egypt, Hamas in the West Bank and Gaza. The stand taken by those groups, small as they are in absolute numbers, but compelling and commanding as they are in the psychological identity with the land that was surrendered, especially with the PLO-Israeli agreement or the Jordanian-Israeli negotiations, these groups keep alive that tragic loss of land where people were forced to compromise and to give up something that was absolutely sacred and that was absolutely pivotal. Now, as this map suggests, the state of Palestine was to be a fairly large area. Jerusalem is in the middle of that, but was to be an international city, and Jerusalem remains now, from my analysis, the key issue in the future of the Middle East peace process, but a solvable one, and one that I think that the solution's already on the board. But that state of Palestine was not achieved and will not be achieved because following that war, this was the context. The shaded area in the West Bank, the West Bank of the Jordan River, was the area that the Jordanian, the Arab Legion, controlled in 48 and up to 1967. The shaded part in the Gaza Strip was controlled by Egypt following the 48 war. But then in 67, through a history that's now being very interestingly rewritten by Israeli historians, a revisionist historical move. I talked to some of the people that are doing this in the last month, and it is unbelievable the way they're reframing the declassification of military documents. This supports to about 75% the stories of the Palestinians as to how they were evicted and how their homes were taken and the massacres and so forth. Previously it supported maybe 10%. The revisionist history is fun to watch as it's being offered by the very best Israeli historians at Hebrew University in Bar-Ilan and Tel Aviv and Haifa, not by Palestinian revisionists. But as they rewrite that history and talk about the threats and talk about the myths, one of the great myths was that Arab governments advised Palestinians living in Israeli territory to leave, that they would then be brought back to their homes, the right of return following the Arab triumphs in the war, which, of course, never came. But subsequent documentation suggests that that never happened, that listening to radio tapes and interviewing people and the actual histories unclassified now of the Israeli military suggest that far more they were forcibly evicted and threatened and ritual massacre as a condition to incite them to flee to the West Bank or to Jordan or to Syria or to Lebanon or to get out of the area totally. But this was the area that was governed. And this is the area that we're now talking about in the peace process. We gave up on the early Palestinian state borders, and we're now dealing with the 67 war armistice borders. And the current discussions are for the Palestinians, the PLO, as the only legitimate representative body of Palestinians, to take over the Gaza Strip and then to eventually take over the West Bank. Currently, it's the Jericho-Gaza first step before subsequent negotiations work out the details. 2 weeks ago, agreement was finalized on transfer of five areas to the Palestinian Autonomous Government, the Palestinian Authority, in Gaza Strip and in Jericho. And those five areas are health, education, social welfare, taxation, tourism. That's the five. And the agreements are in, the procedures are in place to set that up. Now, another one of the issues, in addition to the shifting power balance, and one more variable in the shifting power balance was the Gulf War. That was a critical step because for a rare time in history, the United States really allied with Arab governments. And for a rare time in history, Arab governments were fighting each other. And the opportunity for the coalition, which, while I'm not a George Bush supporter, I think was handled remarkably well by Bush and Baker. The process of putting that together did create for the United States a future role in the Middle East that was both an opportunity and an obligation. The price of that coalition was that we resolved the Palestinian issue. A lot of people don't realize that, but that was absolutely essential. That coalition could not have been put together without Baker specifically promising to Arafat personally and to Mubarak in Egypt and Fahd in Saudi Arabia and Assad in Syria, Sabaz in Kuwait, that the United States would not just encourage, but would take absolutely decisive steps in Middle East in resolving the Palestinian negotiation. But it aligned us with a new axis, and it also further fragmented the Arab world, and that fragmentation is still tragic, of course. And to some degree Jordan, and Yemen, and some other places, placed on a different axis in terms of the whole approach. But it did give us the opportunity and the obligation to resolve the Palestinian issue, to use, with the demise of the Soviet Union, to use the superpower obligations to deal with that. Well, another issue is personalities. I don't think that anybody but Itzhak Rabin could have solved or could have negotiated with the Palestinians. He is the only Israeli leader that I know about and that most Israeli experts that I talk to agree could have negotiated with the PLO without his government falling. Rabin's general of past wars, the chief of staff, the minister of defense, and the previous prime minister, for whom security was the ultimate criterion. And he is the only person, I think, certainly nobody in the Likud, certainly not Benjamin Netanyahu, certainly not Shimon Peres, certainly not Ariel Sharon, certainly not Shamir, the only person that the people would trust a secret negotiation with the Palestinians, because they have known for so long that he is the best person in Israeli history, maybe after Moshe Dayan, to ensure Israeli security. And so he was given a much freer hand than anybody else would have been, and he felt that history was running and that nobody else in the future, in the foreseeable future, could negotiate. Personalities are key. A year and a half ago, in a very choice and an exciting opportunity that I had to meet in Tunis with the PLO Executive Committee and Yasser Arafat, I developed a whole new frame, a whole new perspective, a whole new way of thinking. And let me just cite this personality issue. I don't think anybody but Arafat could sign the PLO either in an agreement. And it was interesting to hear Arafat explain what had happened in his life. Two things happened. One of which is the attractive blonde in this picture, who is his wife, Suha Arafat. When they married 3 years ago, she was 29, he was 63. First marriage for both. She grew up in Paris, has a master's degree in literature from the Sorbonne. She's wealthy, and she's a Roman Catholic. A very interesting person. And she said, this is enough. It's time for peace. You've been a warrior long enough. We want to have children, and they must grow up in a world of peace. We've got to solve this thing. She has worked with children's causes, with UNESCO, with other United Nations groups. A fairly interesting person. Not the most popular person in the Islamic fundamentalist school, but a very powerful and a very articulate individual. And Suha is responsible for a lot of the Mideast peace negotiation. Personalities are critical in that world. The great man theory of leadership, for those of you who are in anything close to my field, and for those of you who aren't, I will offer an explanation another day. But the great man theory of leadership lives in the Middle East. It lives in a lot of the world. And they do rely on personalities. And that was one of the reasons that Saddam Hussein had as much support as he did during the Gulf War, because he was a great leader, not a good leader, not an effective leader, but great in the sense that he had power and controlled resources and could flaunt the West. And that was enough for a lot of people to sign on. Anyway, so that great individual notion, Suha had a big influence. And Arafat said since 19... What was it, Derek? When did he take over the PLO? 64? 66. Since then, I've been married to the PLO. Now I'm married to Suha, and the world must change. Life is that simple. Secondly, 6 months prior, he had been in a near-fatal plane crash in the Libyan desert. Nobody thinks it was sabotage. I've talked to people who were on the plane, and no one thinks it was sabotage. It was just a vicious sandstorm in the Libyan desert. Arafat is a mystic, a real mystic. 30 seconds before the plane crashed in the desert, he changed seats. He got up from one seat and moved to another seat. The seat he was originally sitting in was blown 100 yards into the desert in 1,000 pieces. The seat he moved to settled gently into the sand. And he said, God did not preserve my life to continue being a warrior. 6 months previously, to advocate negotiation with Israel would have meant death to any PLO leader. In November of 1992, when I was there, to advocate anything else meant expulsion from the PLO. The world can change, and it can change dramatically, and it can change fast. I was impressed with the number of PLO executive committees who are young. I was impressed with the number who are Christians. It might surprise you to note the number who are Jews of the PLO Executive Committee. It's a very different world than it was previously. Abu Nidal is a severe enemy of Arafat and the PLO, and not many years before he was part of it. And George Habash in Damascus, and Hawatmi, and Jibril, others who are on that fringe of the Middle East movements, are no longer part of that PLO Executive Committee. The members now are young, they're pragmatic, they're educated, the majority have advanced degrees from American universities. They are a very different breed of people. And one of them who has become the prime negotiator for the Palestinians, and who I predict will be the administrative head of the Palestinian state, Nabil Shah, has a PhD in business, taught at the University of Pennsylvania at the Wharton School for many years, is a very remarkable pragmatic individual, and he is the one doing most of the negotiation and most of the day-to-day administration. Has had a very successful consulting firm in Cairo and is now living in Gaza. And that's the kind of person. And these people are not warriors. The warriors are gone. They're tired. They have agreed that the all-or-nothing strategy of the last decades doesn't work. If there's any single contribution that I think I made to the Palestinian process, it was working through that issue. The fact that the Israelis are masters at incremental bargaining, the Palestinians and most of the Arab world has always taken an all-or-nothing bargaining position. It's the whole land or nothing. And my answer to them is, so far it's been nothing and it will continue to be nothing. You've got to learn the art of incremental bargaining. And they did it quite well, and King Hussein is doing it very well now. And they are moving dramatically in terms of that process. Personalities are critical, absolutely critical. Another critical personality that doesn't get a lot of press is Boutros-Ghali, the Secretary General of the United Nations. I hope you realize that he is a Coptic Christian married to a Jew. I hope you realize that he is an Egyptian that emerged from the head of the Arab League in a troubled world and would probably only have gained his appointment with some very unique credentials. And he is a very powerful force for peace in the Middle East. The number of Christians is still small, but it's a terribly important part of the Middle East peace process. But now that raises another issue, and I've got to give Randy time to explain all these things, because Randy understands this. This is his field, and so I've got to hurry along here. The internal conflicts within the Palestinian world and within the Middle East world are brutal right now. And those conflicts turn on several issues. The term Islamic fundamentalist is a very unfortunate misnomer. Please don't get hooked on that term. Islamic fundamentalists, like any fundamentalist, believes deeply in God and in their responsibility to God, and that they have a higher commitment than daily kinds of achievements. The issue, as Mayor Teddy Kollek said before he was outvoted as mayor of Jerusalem, the issue is not between Arabs and Jews. The issue is between moderates and extremists. And that's even more true in the Arab-Palestinian sector than it is between Jews and Israelis. And what we're talking about is hard to measure, but my best estimate is maybe 10 to 15% of the population that I would classify in the extremist camp. And that translates into conflicts between Shiites and Sunnis within the Muslim world. It translates into conflicts with Christians and Muslims. The Christian population of the Holy Land is declining, the Christian Arab population, partly because the Muslims have a much higher birth rate, and partly because while I was walking in the streets of Jerusalem 3 weeks ago, a Hamas gang trashed Christian stores in the old city. That hasn't happened much in the past. In Bethlehem, virtually every Christian store, Bethlehem and Nazareth and Jerusalem are the three places that Christian Arabs are concentrated. In each of those places, severe violence. And life is very difficult for Christians. They're threatened all the time. In the Samaritan community on Mount Gerizim in the north, where they still practice the ancient Samaritan rituals, including the blood sacrifices on the mountain where they say is the holy mountain where Moses and Abraham offered Isaac and so forth, a very important site in religious history. They are still there. They have their community, and they are now reporting daily vandalism by Hamas. Gangs coming in and destroying their holy places and vandalizing their stores and their community. Those are internal issues that make things very difficult. Without that, the Palestinian Authority would have been set up and governing quite effectively in Jericho and Gaza. Those forces are real. They are not religious forces, however. They are political forces carrying the banner of fundamentalist Muslim ideology. But many of those people do not believe in God. They are political power plays. Now, some of them do, and that's important to note. Some of them do believe in God, and some of them are very honest and sincere Muslim individuals who demand the land and the conformance with the Quran as a condition of existence, not as a preferable option, but as a condition of existence. And with that demand, it makes it very difficult. But in a recent study done in the West Bank, I should note that when the question was asked, what is the primary attribute you wish to see in the future Palestinian state? They were given four choices. One, socialism. One, Arabism, pan-Arabism that was most popularly supported by Nasser in Egypt, subsequently picked up to some degree by Hafez al-Assad and by Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Arabism, democracy, and Islam. This was a survey of 3,000 Palestinians, carefully controlled. Socialism generated 1%. Socialism is dead as an ideology. The Ba'ath Socialist Party in Syria and Iraq only exists by virtue of the barrel of the gun. Arabism, the pan-Arabic state, generated 10% of support. That is very low, especially considering many of these people in the past bet their life on an Arab state, the notion of an Arab nation. Democracy generated 20%, and an Islamic theocracy generated 60%. Now, we have to understand that in the most educated of all Arab cultures. The Palestinians are without question the most educated of all Arab cultures. You can walk down the street of any Palestinian city and meet PhDs from MIT and Stanford and California and Chicago who are driving taxis. Jobs are tough. Jobs are difficult. But the issue is very curious. The commitment to the Islamic State is real, but it's not the way we interpret it, and it's not the way the West sees it. We must understand that in that same survey, when people were asked about the dress of women, which for many people is regarded as the primary indicator of Islamic fundamentalism, only 25% felt that women's dress was an issue that had to be enforced anymore. Most people think it's much higher. Only 25%. That means long dresses, scarves, head hair covered, and in the extreme, face covered. That's way down. Most of the people, as I interview students, for example, I visited Jordan University several times. BYU just signed a fun agreement with Jordan University a month ago. And as I wandered through Jordan University, many more women have their heads covered than did 5 years ago when I was there, or 3 years ago when I was there. But when you interview them, it's not religious orthodoxy. For many, it's fashion. For many, it's pleasing a father, which a lot of people understand who are going to school and need financial support. And so they please parents. For others, it's a fashion statement. I interviewed a young woman who had just started wearing the, what is it, hijab? The what do you call it? Hijab. Who speaks Arabic? Many who just started wearing it say, I'm doing it as a fashion statement. We're not real enthused with Western clothes. And so we're doing it as a fashion statement. No, I don't go to the mosque. No, I don't care what my father or husband said. I wear it because I want to. During the same period, I spent time with a Bedouin tribe in Jordan, the Bani Hamida tribe, a remarkable group of people. I was really moved as I got in a pickup truck with a 26-year-old Jordanian Bedouin woman, the first woman in the tribe to have a driver's license. She says, you want to go for a ride? And I said, sure. And we got in this truck, unheard of a year ago, for her to ride in a truck with a man other than her husband or her father or brother. She got in the truck, she stepped on the gas of that silly little Toyota, and we went flying over the sand, and it was really fun, and she was really proud. She's married, she has children, and she's the production supervisor for 1,000 women making a heck of a lot of money selling rugs in New York and Copenhagen. And she is a Bedouin that grew up in a world where you had to marry at age 14 someone your father told, and she decided who she married. She has a driver's license. She has a truck. She's a boss. She's a manager. She built her own home, and she's a feisty little soul who dresses very conservatively and who is turning the world upside down. And there are a lot of those people. I know them, and they are fun, and they are saying things must change. And we may choose to dress like we the way we want, but it won't be forced by religious ideology. It may be religious preference, but we will make our decision. Well, anyway, some other issues in the process. I mentioned personalities. I mentioned the Gulf War. I mentioned the shift in the balance of power. I mentioned the politization. Politicization. That's a terrible word. Of a religion in the area, and the whole process by which we're fighting those battles. But most of those are easy issues, except for Jerusalem. When Yitzhak Rabin signed his accord with King Hussein and gave Jordan the right to the holy places in Jerusalem, that was the most powerful bargaining chip in the PLO-Israeli peace negotiation. Giving Jordan that land was, or not the land, the responsibility for those sites was absolutely critical. Of course, you must know that King Hussein just put $6 million into refurbishing the Dome of the Rock, the third most sacred site in Islam, and he feels that he has responsibilities. Of course, King Fahd in Saudi Arabia thinks he has some responsibilities too, and Arafat thinks he does, and the Brotherhood in Jordan think they do. A lot of people want control of those holy sites. It has been given to a legitimate autonomous government, the government of Jordan, the Hashemite Kingdom, under the guise that King Hussein is a literal descendant of the prophet, Muhammad, and that he will have responsibility for those holy sites, and that that will be a key factor of Jerusalem. The Palestinians will have to have a say in the city of Jerusalem. Israel has agreed to that. Publicly, they say they have not and they will not, but there is ample evidence that they have agreed, including signed letters. But Jerusalem will have to become as an international city of some sort. The Jewish capital will have to remain there. I support that. We have not yet, the United States has not yet recognized Jerusalem as the capital. We still claim it's Tel Aviv and have our embassy in Tel Aviv. But it will be recognized as Jerusalem. West Jerusalem will be the Israeli capital. East Jerusalem will be the Palestinian capital. That will be worked out, and that will be an exciting thing to watch. The most important person in that negotiation is Faisal Husseini, who's one of the grand old families of Jerusalem and has his offices in the Orient House in East Jerusalem, and it's a fun thing to go there and see the negotiation of heads of state go there to negotiate with the Palestinians. The Israeli government say they won't recognize them, but even Warren Christopher says that's where we go. So the future of Jerusalem will have to be resolved. It will be done not now, in 2 years, when some other things are done and when some other relationships are worked out. People say, how can you support Yasser Arafat? Well, how could I support most any world leader? It's with a qualification. Arafat was the only person that could deliver the Palestinians. He's not my favorite character on the world scene, but he's not my least favorite either. He's bright, he's articulate, he's sensitive, he's impeccable in his manners, whether it looks like it or not in the press. He's thoughtful, he's funny, he has a steel trap memory, and he is very committed to representing the Palestinian people. I don't think he can manage a Palestinian state. I think that has to be left to someone else. But he is the only one that can deliver it, and he has to be worked with, and he has to be honored along the way. And he will be. Now, he's made some unpopular decisions. Banning two Palestinian newspapers because they were pro-Jordanian, I think was very unfortunate. The Palestinians are by far the most democratic of any Arab group. I say that without apology or without qualification. But they are nowhere near as democratic as I would like. They did ban two newspapers published in Jerusalem. I was in the office of the newspaper that was published as it was banned. And it was a very sad day. Freedom of the press is critical, and it's not there. It will be there. It will be fought for, and Hanan Ashrawi will fight for it and is taking a strong stand and is a person to watch in the future. But in the meantime, they are making some decisions. They are fighting a war internally, trying to control the Hamas and other groups. That means they have to make some very unpopular decisions in the way they govern internally. And a democratic state isn't quite there. Many would argue it's not quite here either in the United States. Those things take time. A couple of other issues I would mention. Metaphors are powerful. Some of you have heard me say that as I interview an Israeli officer, he says, God's on our side, but if we don't win, it's because we weren't ready. The ultimate and individual responsibility for the Jewish soldier. A Palestinian officer said, actually in the Jordanian military, God's on our side, if we don't win, it's because God's not ready. Now that difference in metaphors is very important and very powerful. God's will is all important. Mormons ought to understand that, but I don't think we do. God's will is all important in that world, and translating current political squabbles into God's will is very difficult. And I don't know how to do it. But we have to realize that they have to do it, and that they have to understand that God has to be ready. And when a tunnel collapses and thousands of people are killed in Saudi Arabia during the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, because of a mechanical failure, King Fahd says it was God's will. It wasn't Saudi engineering. It wasn't crowd control. It wasn't that the fans had not been maintained. It wasn't that the people had not been regulated in going between the holy places on a 120-degree day. It was God's will that these people die, that the fans don't work, that the crowd panics and stampedes and 1,800 people are trampled to death. It's God's will. And we've got to understand what that means, the sanctity of the land, the powerful personalities, the time it takes to work out arrangements, the fact that relationships mean everything, the fact that you represent yourself not as a nation, but as a people. And it's really different. In Arabic, the very terms don't mean nations the way we think of the nation state. They mean we the people, in a very similar way that Lakota is translated in the Ogallala Sioux world or the Navajo world. And we have to understand what those concepts mean and how building a state is such a tenuous process given the history of the destruction of an infrastructure, of a people, and the scattering around the Palestinian and the Jordanian and the Lebanese and the Syrian and the U.S. world. But it will be worked out. These personalities are playing their roles and they're playing them well. There's some short-term mess-ups, but they are playing them. And why you see internationally, why you see in Bangladesh and Pakistan, why you see a Taslim and Nasreen jailed, accused, and now I guess released in Scandinavia, as I heard. I've only spent 2 weeks out of the last summer in the United States, so I didn't even know about the O.J. Simpson case and the baseball strike, for which I'm very grateful. And in fact, I was telling Marianne that one of the things that was so nice about being away is that I was uncorrupted by the Western press interpretation of what was going on in the Middle East. I say that cynically, but also realistically, because most of the press reports, as I go back and read things that happened where I was on the ground, they missed the point. They missed the issues. And so my time is up. But let me just end with the optimism. And let me end with a scripture reference. I've had some important people in the church remind me of this particular scripture in Isaiah as being a precondition of the final days. And it says, in that day there will be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrians shall come to Egypt, and the Egyptians into Assyria, and the Egyptians shall serve with Assyria. In that day Israel will be a third with Egypt, with Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the land, whom the Lord blesses, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, mine inheritance. That peace condition must exist before the end. Most people don't see that. A member of my ward where I gave a fireside said, God's got a war planned in that area, and you're getting in his way. I categorically reject that position. I've been instructed by Scripture and philosophy to work hard for peace, and that peace must come before the final day. And there will be a highway. And some of you might guess how moved I was as Jordan and Israel and Egypt announced a highway from Egypt to Jordan through Israel to be started construction within a few weeks, across the southern tip of the Negev, just so many kilometers north of Eilat. A highway is coming. There will be peace. It's an exciting world to be part of, and I hope that you can have enough insight and enough perspective to talk to other people whose judgments may be biased, whose perspectives may be shallow in building that process. Thank you very much, and I'm anxious. I'm anxious to hear Randy put this in a theoretical perspective.
Yeah, right. Let it be known that I pled with Bonner to take as much time as he wanted, because I really wanted to hear what he had to say about his experiences. And I only have a few minutes left, and I think I'm going to drastically change my direction, Bonner. We'll talk theory another time. I think what I was going to talk about was categorization of religious conflict and ways that we can think about it, either sociologically, anthropologically, psychologically, doctrinally, politically. There are all sorts of ways we can cut this thing we call religion and inter- and intra-religious conflict apart to get some more clarity through analysis. Gramsci, a social philosopher of socialist leanings, many years ago, came up with the idea that nationalism was a modern notion that really didn't fit the world very well. He had an idea of groups that he called groups, a very simple term, that cut across all sorts of boundaries, nationalistic boundaries. We might call them tribal groups. I think if he had been familiar with Marcia Deliadi's work in the history of religions, he might have called them mythic groups, groups that share the same religion and practice across even cultural lines. He felt ultimately that the world, as time and space shrinks through technological advance, the world would be separated into these mythic groups. I think he was prophetic. He thought, of course, he was a Marxist, and he thought the people, the common people, would be that mythic group that would cut across all national borders. If he were alive today, he'd just have to change a few labels and said, my theory worked, though. See, it's working. We have various types of Muslims, various types of Christians, and others who are aligning as what people would think in not too distant past were strange bedfellows. And that brings me to a point that I just see as a theme through everything that Bonner said, and that is the power of personality in the individual in a world that has been reduced by much social theory in the last 50 years to economics and political power, it's interesting that the word even came out of this organizational man, the great man theory that has been so debunked. We have here a discussion of world-shattering and moving events that are happening, and an on-the-site witness, albeit he admitted that there were many billions of dollars changing hands as part of this transaction, that it took particular individuals in a time and a place to get the thing accomplished. Bonner himself is an inspiration to me. I've got to say, you know, I've always wondered in my own life which I admired more, a man of action or a contemplative man. And here we have someone who's clearly both. I'm going to get Mormon religious and personal here in my last 3 minutes. Guess who said this? Oh, how our world needs statesmen. And we ask again with George Bernard Shaw, why not? We have the raw material. We have the facilities. Raise your hand when you know. We can excel in training. We have the spiritual climate. We must train statesmen, not demagogues. Men of integrity, not weaklings who for a mess of pottage will sell their birthright. We must develop these precious youth, that's a Mormonism there, to know the art of statesmanship, to know people and conditions, to know situations and problems. Those who will be trained so thoroughly in the arts of their future work and in the basic honesties and integrities and spiritual concepts that there will be no compromise of principle. Anyone want to guess? It's Brigham Young-like. You got it. Spencer W. Kimball. This is in one of those liberal magazines, The Ensign, July 1977. I think Brother Ritchie is a person who is doing things without asking permission, doing much righteousness in his own way and having a good time of it too. I think I'm very optimistic about the way Mormonism and Mormon people are getting involved in statesmanship like Bonner Ritchie. I'm very optimistic that I read in last week's Church News. Has anybody ever seen the Church News? It's an organ put out by the LDS Church. In their editorial page, listen to this. We make those snap judgments and categorize things, even people, all the time. Now we have a descriptive phrase for it, pigeonholing. The problem is, once an item or a person is pigeonholed, we're in danger of leaving them there, uninspected and possibly unused. And we assess them by the mental labels of the pigeonhole into which we place them. Specifically, we assume that having once labeled that person as a Mormon, for example, or a Catholic, or a Jew, or a Muslim, we then assume that we know all we need to know about them. That's a foolish way to build friendships, and it ignores much of the wealth of experience that they and their cultures have accumulated throughout their lives. We have so much invested in the success of our common humanity that we cannot afford to put people into convenient pigeonholes or preconceptions. More than that, however, is the loss that comes from not getting to know people for who they really are. It can even become dangerous. The world is currently witness to heart-wrenching examples of ethnic conflicts, read religious, racial conflicts. That word ethnic, I think it should be tossed out. We ought to call it more accurately in the case on the ground, but that's a Randy comment here. Let me continue with the editorial. And even whole populations are in mortal peril because others cannot see beyond their labels. The Lord has not taken that approach. One last paragraph of this. It's clear that what counts with the Lord is not gender, nor race, nor nationality, nor education, nor many of the other labels by which we pigeonhole people. The things that do matter are faithfulness, charity, love, compassion, patience, hope, obedience, virtue, all attributes that defy assignment to any one group of people. It's the height of arrogance to assume that we can judge people on those important characteristics by simply categorizing them by convenient ethnic, religious, national, or other labels we are too prone to use as a people. Well, here we have, coming right to us, something wonderful. We have President Hunter giving a speech at the memorial to Joseph Smith's martyrdom in Illinois, where the famous song, Praise to the Man, used to, in the second verse, say, stain Illinois with the death of Joseph laid at their feet. We have a prophet who got up and didn't mention that, but said that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is a world religion, not because it has its missionaries and congregations and members all over the world, but because it embraces the truth and goodness that is found in every people throughout the world. We have this attempt to send our statesmen from the prophet to Bonner to all of us in our own ways. We reach out and see the complexities, the difficulty of pigeonholing these things. I think if we've learned anything today, it's that we need to be on ground, on place, to really understand something well, and that individuals can make an enormous difference. I think my time's up, isn't it? Do we have any time for questions at all?
I don't think so.
I'd have to stay and talk, answer questions.
Yeah, anybody that wants to sit with Bonner, I think we're off the air. Okay, we can take a few questions. Let's ask Bonner some questions. Go ahead.
One thing that I've been seeing in the news is difficulties by the Palestinian police to deal with some of the radical groups. And I wonder if this issue of power, if you and I are on equal ground and now all of a sudden you're police and you're telling me that I can't do what we used to do together, possibly. I don't know. I'm theorizing there. What's going on there? And are they going to be able to get that under control, or are they going to lose?
I can't tell you how exciting it is for someone who's spent a lot of time in places like Jericho and Gaza City to walk down the streets in those cities and see Palestinian flags flying rather than Israelis, to see no Israeli soldiers in the streets, to see Palestinian police regulating traffic, laughing with people, and so forth. That is really exciting. For them to step in and break up these gangs and the Hamas movements is tough. I think they'd lose control if they tried. At the sad crossing at Eretz a few weeks ago, where there was fire and some really unfortunate conflict, I was there the day before and talked to some of the police, and they didn't know how to keep the crowds back. They said it would be absolutely inexcusable for us to shoot Palestinians trying to go to work in Israel. You see, the majority of Palestinians in Gaza work in Israel and have to cross that point at 3 o'clock every morning to get to work in order to earn enough money to survive. Unemployment is 60% in the Gaza Strip. They can't exercise that kind of control and maintain any moral authority right now. They've got to work into it. It's like assigning somebody in Medellin to control the Medellin cartel in drug traffic. How many judges have been killed in Colombia? I was on the Colombian border day before yesterday and trying to understand the situation. And, they can't. Don't be too optimistic about New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles or Miami either. They can't move in and get control immediately. You're right, Derek. That is a tragic and long-term process, and there's going to be some conflict that runs for a while. But they do have a moral authority that's working right now. It's more stable than I ever dreamed it would be, and crime has gone down dramatically. And yes, there have been some arrests of Palestinians by the Palestinian police, and they are making progress, but it's going to take a while. But I'm encouraged.
I have a question for you.
Let me ask a question that wasn't asked. When Randy was reading from President Kimball, I had to pull out my quote from a current church leader made several years ago. In 1979, Elder Howard W. Hunter admonished church members to remember that both Jews and Arabs are children of God. They are both children of promise, and as a church, we should not take sides. We have love and interest in each. The purpose of the gospel is to bring about love, unity, brotherhood, and peace. President Hunter, more than any single individual, has been responsible for an enlightened BYU and church attitude toward the Palestinian and Arab world. There's a Muslim in Jerusalem who said, when Howard Hunter becomes president of the church, I will become a Mormon. Because he had made such an impact on people over there. I'm waiting. But Randy had a question.
Let's have
the authority.
I'm sure we'll be able to talk a little bit more afterwards. Well, Professor.
And thanks for joining us for this session of the Sunstump Symposium. We're coming to you again live from the Salt Lake Hilton Hotel, 150 West, 200 South, 150 West on 500 South, Salt Lake City. And we've been listening to Jay Bonarici. He read a paper entitled The Quest for Peace in the Middle East. Actually, it was probably less a paper and more of a spontaneous discussion of the events that he's been closely involved with. He's been working with Palestinian, he's been a consultant to Palestinian organizations and has been working with Yasser Arafat and others in that organization to bring about peace in the Middle East. And he was briefly answered by Charles Randall Paul, who is a PhD candidate at the University of Chicago and the Committee on Social Thought and a social theorist interested in methods of engagement and in religious conflict. We'll be bringing you one more session today in this year's broadcast of the Sunstone Symposium. We'll be bringing you an interview with Sterling M. McMurrin, a well-known Mormon philosopher and a person with a chair of philosophy named after him at the University of Utah, and former education commissioner under John F. Kennedy. And he will be interviewed by Laura DePadova, who is a PhD candidate in organizational behavior at Rockefeller College, State University of New York at Albany. And this will be our final broadcast session of this day and of this year's Sunstone Symposium broadcast. We thank you for tuning in, and make sure to tune in just about 7 minutes or so. We'll be beginning another session, which, as I mentioned just now, will be our final session. And we hope you'll join us for Sterling M. McMurrin. And just a reminder again that tapes are available for each of the sessions that you've heard broadcast on the air today, and tapes are also available for about 5 or 6 sessions during each hour that are not being broadcast over the air. And you can call the Salt Lake Hilton at 532-3344. Ask for the Sunstone desk, and we can tell you more about those tapes. Until we join session number 375 with Sterling M. McMurrin, we will return you now to the studios of KCPW.